non-harmfulness, also the mental factor of compassion. So the three types of compassion. The first one is compassion observing sentient beings. And so this is regarding sentient beings as under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment, karma, and therefore having to take rebirth again and again without choice. So think of somebody that you know. Could be a friend, somebody you care about. And instead of thinking, oh, this is my friend, and they have this great personality, and we did this together, and we're going to do that together, instead of looking at them the way you usually do, just look at them and think, this person is under the influence of their own ignorance, anger, and attachment. They don't perceive the nature of reality. And so because of that misconception, they have faults. They get angry and attached and jealous and so forth. And they create negative actions. And so here's this person that wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. But their mind is not free. It's controlled by ignorance. And so they constantly create the cause for more problems in their life. And we can see that our friend has faults. As much as we care about them, we can see that they create negative actions. Their mind's not free from this ignorance. And so this whole situation is gonna keep going again and again. This friend is going to die, and they may have a good death, they may not. Depends on their mind, depends on their karma. And then some of the karma, the previous actions that they've created before, those imprints are going to ripen at the time of death. And our friend's going to be propelled to take another body, and another personality, and another place, and start life all over again. And we won't recognize them, they'll be different. And they'll go through that life. And then because of the ignorance, because of the karma, the same thing will happen at the end of that life. Karma will ripen. The mind stream will be attracted to another body. And you take rebirth again. And so each time you take rebirth, going to be stuck with a body that gets old and sick and dies. Each time they take rebirth, even though they want happiness, because of the ignorance, anger, and attachment, they'll keep having problems in their lives. They'll do actions that harm themselves and harm others. They'll have some happiness, but the happiness won't last permanently. And is to really think deeply about the real situation that your friend is in, and develop compassion, the wish that they be free of those unsatisfactory conditions and their causes. Imagine your friend being born in different bodies and looking different and acting different, all without control. Karma will pursue them as a shadow follows the body. And so let real compassion arise for them by understanding what the whole situation that they're in is. And then expand and recognize this is the situation of each and every sentient being. Everybody you meet on the street. All the humans, all the bugs. Whatever, this is the same situation that they're all in. And let that compassion arise, wishing them to be free of the suffering and its causes, by clearly understanding what the suffering is and what the causes are. Second type of compassion. Compassion regarding phenomena, observing phenomena. So here we focus specifically on sentient beings as being impermanent. And so come back and think of your friend again. And recognize that they have no permanent, heartless, independent soul. That there's something constantly changing. Moment by moment, their body changes. It doesn't remain the same. Moment by moment, their mind changes. It too isn't stable. And so focus on your friend being transient, being momentary, changing each split second. And as you focus on their transience, it becomes real evident how much suffering they experience in grasping for transient pleasure. That your friend spends so much time trying to hold on to things that give pleasure. And yet those things are changing each moment. Your friend's body and mind is changing each moment. Really focus how futile your friend's situation is, looking for pleasure from external things. And then let the compassion arise for them experiencing that. And generalize that to all beings. This is the situation that all sentient beings are in. Bodies changing each moment, mind is changing each moment, grasping for pleasure and security, completely futile. I really think how wonderful it would be if all beings were free from this situation. And then the third kind of compassion is objectless compassion. So this is observing sentient beings and recognizing that they are not inherently existent. So come back to your friend again and recognize that there's absolutely no solid personality in that person. Body, their body is changing, aging, the mind is changing, moment by moment. What we call our friend is simply labeled on top of that changing combination of body and mind. There's nothing else there. Our friend exists simply by being merely labeled on top of this ever-changing body and mind. Beyond that label, there's no friend. There's no personality. There's no person. Even though that's the reality, because your friend doesn't understand it, they grasp at themselves as being solid, as being inherently there. And so they get involved in all the disturbing attitudes, creating so much karma, bringing so many problems. So all this is actually totally unnecessary. And so focus on the non, your friend as being non-inherently existent. And then all the suffering and problems as really being unnecessary, as being solvable, but as being a tragedy because they haven't been solved yet, although it's actually simple. And let the compassion for them arise. And then generalize that to all the sentient beings. None of them have any solid personality or solid existence beyond what is merely labeled on the ever-changing accumulation of the body and mind. So focusing on that, let the compassion come because the sentient beings themselves don't recognize that. They don't recognize that there's no solid person that they have to defend and protect. And the compassion here can be especially strong because it becomes so clear how all of their disturbing attitudes, all of their misery, is really unnecessary. I also wish them to be free of it and its causes. happened in that meditation. Sometimes it's helpful because it is easier to think of it from somebody else and then generalize back to ourselves that this is our own situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear what the real situation is. So all the buzziness of the emotions just really coming back to what Tom said, I think that sometimes that clarity might be more in the nature of compassion, you know, than what we usually consider compassion. Or at least that clarity can set the stage for a feeling of compassion to arise. And so we can see compassion isn't some kind of, you know, crazy, you know, out of control thing, but it's quite clear. But with a, you know, it's the clarity, but with a deep feeling of connectedness to the people, because their situation is ours. The charge, but there's no person there. Mm-hmm. You know?
And it's part of that.
Yes. There's a definite benefit in doing this every day. And this is the kind of meditation I do on planes a lot. Because I really have a feeling on planes, because I'm like leaving one reality, you know, leaving some people's reality and then dropping it on other people's reality. So it comes very strong, this feeling of simply being a conditioned phenomena and everybody else around me just being conditioned, being transient, being impermanent, you know. And you know, I'll look around on the planes and I'll look at all the people who, you know, they're all, some are going for holiday and some are going for business and some are going for happiness and some are going because of sadness, and yet they all feel their lives are so incredibly important and what's happening to them is the most essential thing in the whole universe, you know, and yet we're all just karmic bubbles. Yeah, it takes care of a lot, actually. And I think this, you know, so it enables us to extend to many people, but it also enables us, as a lot of you have said, to take the charge out of the close relationships that we are in and to recognize it. That our friends are simply like every other sentient being in the universe. You know, wanting happiness, their mind's completely out of control, their body's completely out of control. And that they're not going to be the person we know them to be, is, you know, as time goes on, either later in this life or next life. They're going to be somebody else, born somewhere else, totally unidentifiable to us. And yet, you know, their wish for happiness, their misery of experiencing pain, that's the same. Whether we're near and dear to them this life or when we're born, you know, universes away in next life. And so it has a enables us to see them more realistically, thus cutting down on the attachment, and thus showing us a way to have, to begin to have real compassion for the situation people are in. But real compassion isn't, you stubbed your toe, poor baby, That is compassion, but the kind of compassion we're talking about in Buddhism is really deep and extensive. If you can get a sense of how that compassion doesn't end until samsara ends. And then you can also remember that there are bodhisattvas and Buddha who have that kind of compassion for us. Shall we go on? Actually, what we're going on to fits in very well with that meditation, because we're going to start to talk about the causes of all of this suffering, the disturbing attitudes that are the source of this whole thing. And so as we understand this too, it helps us see our own mind clear and see our friend's qualities clearer too. Okay, so the disturbing attitudes are distinct mental factors that when they arise in our mind cause the mental continuum to be unpeaceful and unsubdued. So that's us, huh? Yeah. So these things, these are attitudes or aspects or factors in our mind that cause turbulence. So it's quite interesting to think whenever we're feeling unsubdued, unpeaceful, turbulent, to think, this is because there's a disturbing attitude present in my mind. Instead of thinking this is because so-and-so did this and that. I'm feeling unpeaceful and unsubdued because a disturbing attitude is present in my mind. So there's different ways to speak about the disturbing attitudes. The Buddha talked one way about 84,000. But then there's similarly 84,000 positive aspects too, so don't get discouraged. And another way to categorize them is into what we call the 6 root disturbing attitudes and the 20 auxiliary ones. Okay, so the 6 roots are called roots because they are the root of cyclic existence. They're the fundamental things that keep cyclic existence going. And also because they're the roots or sources for all the auxiliary or secondary disturbing attitudes. What's in and all of these disturbing attitudes, whether they're the root ones or the secondary ones, are negative in and of themselves. They don't need any other factor to make them negative. Okay, but because they are based on a misconception of inherent existence, then they become, and because they misapprehend the object, then they become something disturbing and therefore to be abandoned. Okay? And what's interesting about all these disturbing attitudes, because we'll talk about them, even though we're talking about clinging, attachment and anger and jealousy and pride and laziness and all this kind of stuff, is that these are all conceptual minds. This is very interesting to think about, because usually when we have a strong disturbing attitude arising, we don't think of it as in any way related to concept. We relate to it so much as a gut feeling. And this is showing that some of our concepts are pretty gut feelings of ours too. Okay? But as we begin to really do research on these disturbing attitudes and understand them deeper, it's quite interesting to see how they do rely so much on conception, so much on how we interpret, how we view, what our paradigm is, how we frame whatever it is. And that gives us a whole different perspective on these things, because then instead of thinking, like whenever we have a turbulent feeling, instead of thinking, you know, my feeling is right, it's justified because the situation is really like I'm perceiving it, we begin to see, you know, this turbulent feeling is based a lot on concept, and it's based a lot on incorrect concept. Not only the concept that grasps an inherent existence, but also a whole lot of other concepts that are in there that make a whole mishmash of our lives. And so we start, you know, pulling these things out. It's like, you know, untangling some incredible ball of yarn as we start to see all these different threads that go into creating the tumultuous situations we find ourselves in. So it's quite helpful for understanding our mind, and quite good to really, you know, I mean, this is all stuff that's so powerful for meditation. You know, to really think about and look at our own mind and look at what happens and understand what's really going on. Yeah. So that next time, you know, we're angry, or next time we're really attached, instead of getting completely into the object that we are clinging or have aversion to, you know, step back and study the attachment, study the anger. What's going on there? How am I really thinking? What's really going on in my mind? I'm so observing it. It's really interesting. You won't get bored. Okay, so the first of the root delusions, well, you know, let me just do an overview of them. Okay, we have five that are called non-speculative, because we aren't speculating about philosophy, and then five that are speculative. So, or the sixth one, which has five parts, and that one's the speculative one. So we have, you know, clinging attachment, anger, pride, ignorance, and deluded doubt. Okay, so those are the non-speculative ones. And then deluded views, of which there's five types. View of the transitory collection, view holding to an extreme, holding a wrong view as supreme, holding incorrect ethics and modes of conduct as supreme, and wrong views. These are all speculative ones. We're involved somewhat with philosophical speculation, but not simply philosophical speculation, because these are very deep, innate gut concepts through which we filter the world, too. So remember, as we're talking about concept here, we're not necessarily talking about what we, you know, what we usually observe of as concept, which is all the very obvious thoughts that we have in our mind. But here, what we're doing is we're beginning to research and see that thought has many, many layers, and that a lot of things we're using thought and using concept where before we thought we weren't. Okay. So that thought, concept, conceptual mind can be, it's not just, you know, oh, I'm thinking about yellow, but it's like real fundamental ways through which we filter everything we perceive. Okay, so the first one here is clinging attachment, our old favorite one. Yeah? So this is a distinct mental factor that, when referring to a contaminated phenomena, exaggerates its attractiveness and then wishes for and takes a strong interest in it. Okay? So, okay, contaminated phenomena, there's different definitions of this. In terms of objects, a contaminated phenomena can be whatever arises due to disturbing attitudes and karma. And in terms of subjects, it's any mind which is not a direct, bare perception of emptiness. Okay. Or another way to think about it as contaminated means things which are caused by the disturbing attitudes. Okay, so we refer to a contaminated phenomena. Okay, it could be any contaminated phenomena. You know, we start with our body and we work outwards, you know, to anything, physical thing we see, you know, people we see, ideas we have, places we go to, all the stuff that we usually contact. And we exaggerate the attractiveness of these things. And because we exaggerate the attractiveness, then we have a strong interest. And I really want this. And so we really want it. And then we really need it. You know, we go from wanting it to needing it. You know, so that there's no way I can be happy without this. Absolutely no way. If I don't have this thing, there's no way I can be happy at this present moment. It's like when you're really, really hungry and your mind just focuses on food, the mind gets totally locked into, I cannot be happy in this moment if I don't have food. Okay? And so we do that with food. We do this in this country with relationships so much. If I don't have this relationship, I'm not going to be able to survive. I need this person. I need this relationship. Or I need this job, I need this identity. Yeah. So we get completely, you know, our mind gets so wrapped around something and so contorted and tight that we severely limit our own possibilities for happiness at any particular moment. Because our mind gets so latched on to needing or wanting one thing, you know, when in fact the universe is full of stuff. So everything else becomes the cause of suffering because we have decided that only this one little thing, you know, this one little thing is the only thing that can make me happy right now. You know, if I'm not with this one person, you know, all the 5 billion other sentient beings are not going to make me happy. Those are just the human beings on this planet. Forget the animals and all the other. None of them have the form to me. I cannot be happy no matter with anybody else because I want to be with this one. Okay. So we cause ourselves tremendous suffering. So we can see, you know, how our mind gets locked into something. You know, I want to go out and have Italian food tonight. If we don't have Italian food, there's no way I'm going to be happy. You know, I'm going into this meeting and my idea is a good one. You know, if people don't recognize my idea, there's no way I'm going to be happy. I want my life to be like this. You know, I have an image of what my life should be like. If my life doesn't turn out like that, I am not going to be happy. And so, you know, all this suffering completely comes from our own mind. You know, through the power of attachment. Because we've severely limited our way of being happy because we're clinging on to one thing and tuning out everything else that's there. And then the attachment, as if that isn't enough. I mean, it's real interesting. Do a real serious study of like what attachment does in our life. You know, what are we like when we're under the influence of attachment? You know, when we're really stuck on something, when we're really craving something. What does our mind become like? Yeah, what's the energy in our mind? It's like bubbling water, isn't it? Yeah, everything's so restless, so dissatisfied, so it's bubbling, you know, just with this restlessness, because we want something. You know, I'm wanting, I'm needing, I have to have. There's this internal, you know, restlessness that never seems to calm down. And then that manifests externally, you know, the internal mind of attachment manifests externally by all the trips we do to get the things we're attached to. So this is another about how that attachment feels in the mind, what the feeling quality in your mind is. And then, you know, from there go on to really observe, you know, look through your whole life, all the aspects of your life, and what does the attachment make me do? How does it influence how I live my life? And then we begin to see all sorts of dysfunctional behavior patterns, okay? Because that's when we begin to see how we hint for things for people. We begin to see all the ways in which we manipulate, you know, how we drop hints, how we do stories, how we play games. We begin to see like whole patterns in our life that we do every time, repeatedly, you know, in certain situations in an attempt to feed our attachment and get what it is we're attached to. Okay. We start to see how the attachment makes us be very hypocritical sometimes, very dishonest with other people. We pretend to be one way, but we're not really that way. You know, we're painting one face on ourselves so that this person likes me, so that then I'll have what I want. Okay? Because either they have the material thing or they offer the relationship, whatever it is. So we get into all sorts of incredibly weird behavior. You know? And this kind of behavior is often what gives us a lot of problems in our lives. You know, how we act under the influence of attachment when we're trying to get what we want. You know? So, you know, beyond the manipulation and the dishonesty, sometimes we get out and out unethical. Okay? Because it's the attachment that very often makes us steal, you know, or lie, or have, you know, sexual relationships outside of our own relationship. We can kill out of attachment. We do so many things out of attachment, and thus creating more negative karma, more obscuration on our mind. Yeah. So it's like, this is why, you know, when they explain the Four Noble Truths, when they talk about the second one, the source or origin of cyclic existence, attachment is pointed out as that one. Even though ignorance is like the real root, attachment is pointed out when we discuss the Four Noble Truths. Because attachment is what keeps the world going round. Okay? You know, it's really what motivates us. It's just, we just get into one thing after another in this, you know, as one Lama said, our struggle for pleasure. You know, we struggle for pleasure out of our attachment. And then the attachment makes us perpetually dissatisfied because we never get enough pleasure. Or we get it and then it disappears and then we have to struggle to get it again. Or we get the thing that's supposed to be so pleasurable and it isn't as good as it was supposed to be. Yeah. We thought it was going to be so wonderful. We thought we were going to live happily ever after. We thought this thing was going to solve all of our problems. And we get it, and we're right back where we started again, dissatisfied. So then we're disillusioned plus dissatisfied. So I think this is actually what makes a lot of Americans very receptive to Buddhism. Because somehow we know this in our gut, you know, because we have the American dream. We have our ancestors, due to the kindness of our ancestors who came to this country, you know, we have the land of plenty, and yet it still doesn't make us happy, does it? You know? We still go out and buy the latest thing that we're supposed to have and do the latest fun activity we're supposed to do, and we're still unhappy. And so, you know, somehow at some level we really recognize that and happiness doesn't come from chasing after the external objects. So at some level we see the disadvantages of attachment. But the difficulty is that we're so addicted to attachment that we keep following it anyway. Yeah. We're just attachment junkies. And, you know, and we are. We're addicted to the latest buzz, the latest high, the latest thing that's going to make us feel good. And so we keep chasing after it, even though we know at some level it's not going to do it for us. So we're kind of like, you know, when the scientists do experiments with these rats, you know, when the rat pecks, you know, if the rat pecks and doesn't get any food, then after a while the rat gives up. Okay? If the rat pecks and once in a while gets food, you will keep pecking and keep doing it. It's like this is the same principle behind gambling. You know, you just keep doing it on the off chance that this next peck you're going to get the food. Okay? So that's the way we are with our attachment. We keep pecking away at all these things in our life, thinking this next one's going to do it for me, this next one's going to do it for me. And we get a little bit of happiness and a little bit of pleasure in all these things, enough to keep us, you know, really hooked on the attachment and really going and looking, because the next one's going to be even better. The next one's going to bring me the ultimate happiness. Okay? And so if we look in our lives, you know, not only does the attachment cause us so much internal angst and emotional suffering, and not only does it cause us, you know, problems with other people and cause us to act unethically, but it's the fundamental thing that prevents us from getting enlightened. Because not only does the attachment obscure our mind, but it also keeps us from practicing the path that will unobscure our mind. Okay? So if the attachment is, you know, all this obscuration, then we just need to practice the Dharma to kind of, you know, get rid of it. And yet, why don't we practice the Dharma? Because of the attachment. Because the attachment's pulling us here and pulling us there, and making us run after this and run after that and seek after this and grasp for that. And so we never have time to practice Dharma because our lives are too busy running after objects of attachment. Yeah? We never have time. We don't have time to go on retreats. Yeah? We have too many social obligations and family dinners and this and that and things that I have to do, so I have no time to go on retreat. I have no time to go to Dharma class, you know, because I have all these things in my calendar that I have to do. This is how attachment functions. I can't go to Dharma class, you know, I'm completely exhausted. I really want to rest. I just want to lie on my nice soft bed, you know, or on the nice soft sofa and be amused. You know, we're attached to the television set. We're attached to the soft bed. We can't even get up to go to, you know, go to Dharma class or go to the meditation cushion. The alarm clock rings in the morning. We can't get out of bed because we're so attached to sleeping. So we can't meditate. Yeah. And then we can't meditate during the day because we're too busy running around doing all these things out of attachment to, you know, in our struggle for pleasure. So not only is attachment the thing that obscures our mind, you know, and prevents us from gaining, you know, and is the basic thing why we can't understand reality, but it's also the thing that prevents us from practicing the Dharma, which would unobscure our mind. Okay, so you see how tangled up we are in it? And then whenever somebody starts to talk about the disadvantages of attachment, we get totally freaked out. And we say, but if I give up my attachments, I won't have anything meaningful in my life. I'm going to be a total vegetable. I won't have any ambition. Who am I going to be, you know, if I stop seeking all these things, you know? What am I going to be, you know? Are you telling me I have to leave my partner and go live in a cave and eat nettles and, you know? And we just completely go to this far out extreme, you know, thinking that, you know, starting tomorrow we're going to take expedition into the, you know, Milarepa cave. You know, and then our whole identity goes, well, who am I going to be if I don't have these ambitions and these attachments? What am I going to do with my time? And then even worse, what are other people going to think of me? You know, because if I give up searching, you know, seeking after all these attachments, you know, the people I care about, what are they going to think of me? They're going to think I'm a weirdo. You know, if I don't want to have a whole lot of money and I don't have the same values as they do, they're going to think I'm totally weird. You know, if I don't, you know, really buy nice clothes and go home wearing nice clothes, they're going to think, you know, what's wrong with you. You know, if I don't, if I'm not out, you know, doing well in my career, and if I'm not out, you know, having the perfect relationship and having so much fun and going to all these fun places, then my friends and family, what are they going to think of me? You know, they're not going to like me. And then our attachment to praise and approval and reputation comes in. And we get paralyzed. We can't think of changing because what are other people going to think of us? You know, and they won't like us. And if they don't like me, who am I going to be? And what am I going to be? So please tell me who I am and please tell me how you want me to be and I'll be it, because then I know what I am. And we give our power away. And then we try and become what everybody else wants us to be. And we can't become it. And we're unhappy and we're dissatisfied and we're miserable. We think something's wrong with us. Yeah. But we can't try any other way because we're so totally sunk in with the attachment. Heavy duty, isn't it? Okay, so relating this back to the meditation we did, you know, when we really see what the attachment does in our life, yeah, and taking ourselves as an example and really seeing this, and it's horrifying and it's scary. It's scary to see how they often say we're like donkeys with a, you know, a ring through our nose. Yeah. Here we don't have it so much. You go to India, you see these donkeys, you know. Especially in Dharamsala, they're carrying like this really heavy bricks and slate, and they're, you know, with a ring in their nose. And the ring pulls, and, you know, the donkey has to follow the ring, no choice. And that's how we are with our attachment, you know. The attachment's like the ring in the nose, and it pulls, and we follow it, and we're miserable. Yeah. So when we see this, I mean, it's scary to see how that works in our life. And this is what enables us at some point to have some compassion for ourselves and therefore generate the determination to be free of this. And then when we generalize it to others, we realize this is everybody's situation, and it enables us to have some really deep compassion for other people too. But it's really important, you know, to take a real good look at the attachment. And not in an intellectual way, you know, not dancing around with definitions, but really look at our own life. You know, and you know, start out with, well, what's the energy of attachment in my mind, and how do I really feel when I'm under the influence of attachment? Am I peaceful and tranquil? And then look at our whole life, all these different aspects of our whole life, you know, look at our history and all the way, you know, that attachment has made us act. And then we'll really begin to see, I think, the source of a lot of our psychological problems. Because a lot of the stuff that we get so psychologically hung up with, very much related to really deep-rooted attachment. So even though we can't uproot it right away, at least we get a little bit of clarity about how all that suffering is based on a wrong conception. So it's real important as we're doing this meditation not to think that we're bad because we have attachment. Repeat, you know, do not get into a self-judgmental trip and think that we're bad people because we're attached. But rather look at this situation, the way the attachment controls us, you know, and have some compassion for ourselves, wanting ourselves to be free, and recognizing that this attachment is a wrong conception. You know? that when the attachments overwhelming our minds, we are not perceiving reality. We're not perceiving ultimate reality. We aren't even perceiving conventional reality. We're not perceiving anywhere you look at it, we're out of sync. Okay? Because, you know, just even on the conventional level, because we're so involved in exaggeration and so involved in projection. And we've painted this picture, you know. We've painted this picture of this wonderful situation that I can wrap my arms around and live happily ever after, but it goes away. Just like that. You know, you think you got it, and it jumps out of your lap. Yeah? Right. And then we can't just let him go, then the mind goes, but, it was so nice, you know. You were, that split second that you were there was so nice. Come back, I need you, you know? And so, again, you know, I can't be happy just being who I am, sitting here, being peaceful and relaxed. Instead, my mind's completely contorted, you know, over this past pleasure I had. I've got to reinvent this past pleasure. You know, I've got to have it again. And so we're totally stuck in the past. Or we have a little bit of pleasure, and for the split second, you know, it's in our lap. Then we want to protect it, and we cling on to the pleasant pleasure. We don't want to let it disappear. Or we cling on to future pleasure. Oh, well, it was here, and it jumped out of my lap. But, oh, again. Yes, look, here it's coming. Oh, but I have to, please, I can't live without this, please. I'll trade you this, please. I'll do it, I can't live without this. You can have my house, you can have everything. I have to have this. But that's the way we are in our lives, isn't it? You know, I'll give anything to have the object of my attachment. Please. Oh, finally. Don't go away. It broke. Oh no. How am I going to be be happy with broken chocolate. And it made my table all dirty. Oh, no. Oh, no. This is terrible.
Impermanent. Now then, want a cat? Go get it.
So, this is the story of our lives, isn't it? Okay. So we get totally stuck, you know. The mind's just completely captivated. And, you know, when we talk about freedom, you can see how the mind of attachment is unfree. You know? The mind of attachment has no freedom. And when we often talk about power and, you know, a sense of personal power, when we have attachment, we give away our power. Okay? We often give away our dignity. We give away our self-respect, you know. When we're attached, depending upon how strong our attachment is, we will give away anything. And then we wonder why we're confused and why we're unhappy. So it's real helpful, you know, to really sit and look at that, because as we do, then we begin to see it clear, and our mind becomes stronger and firmer and much more courageous to oppose the attachment, to not buy into it, to not think that, you know, every time we're overwhelmed by attachment that it's the end of the world or the beginning of the world. Yeah. Oh, my next object of attachment. Oh, I want this one. Oh. Oh, it's like, sweetie.
Oh, you don't love me either, do you? You're going to jump out of my lap, too. Oh, I want suffering, huh?
Huh? Huh? Yep. Oh, look, I have my object. I don't want to talk to anybody else. I won't do anything else. I'm completely sunk into my object of attachment. You have a problem. You're suffering. I don't care. All I can pay attention to. Oh.
I don't think I'm really talking
to anyone. Oh, no, my reputation. Oh, no, what are people going to think about me? I mean, my history, my identity is going to be jeopardized now. This is all on tape. So, you know, really helpful to look at this. And then as we see, we begin to see how the attachment is so deceptive, because it makes it appear like we're going to have happiness. I mean, we're so convinced when we have it, when we're attached to something, that it's going to bring us happiness. We're absolutely convinced. We never doubt that. And yet, time and time again, we get disappointed and we get disillusioned. And we're back where we started from. And as we really begin to penetrate and understand that pattern at a deeper and deeper level, and this happens over a period of time, it's not going to happen all at once. But as we understand it deeper and deeper, then our mind gets stronger, and we become more resolute, and we become more aware so that we don't buy it. You know, the attachment may arise, but we don't buy into it so much. We have a little bit of space. We can step back and say, oh, there, look at the attachment, painting these movies, painting these pictures again. You know, but I know what's going to happen if I believe these pictures. I know what's going to happen if I do this. Okay? So our mind becomes stronger. We don't buy into it. And that's when we start really finding some mental peace. When we start really having some freedom. Yeah. Right. Because what happens is we're very extreme, and we think that the only way to be connected to people is through being attached to them. We can't see another way of being connected with them. So we think if we give up the attachment, that we're going to be cold icebergs, uninvolved, unrelated, unconnected, like brick walls. And who wants to be like that? But, I mean, it's helpful to recognize that bodhisattvas aren't cold and, you know, completely backed away. No, bodhisattvas are very much related, very much engaged, very much connected to sentient beings. So there is a way to remain connected, you know, and really heart connected with your heart, but with a pure heart instead of with a confused heart. You know? And so it's real interesting too to spend some time really thinking about, well, what is attachment and what is love? What's the difference between them? You're right. But with attachment, our affection is quite conditional. Yeah, we have affection because people are a certain way or do a certain thing that pleases us. Yeah, that influences us. If it didn't influence us in a pleasant way, we would not be attached to that person. We weren't getting something out of it some way. Okay. So the affection we feel for others out of attachment is very conditional, whereas the kind of love that we're trying to develop through our bodhicitta practice is unconditional. It's simply wanting others to have happiness in its causes, simply because they exist, simply because they're a sentient being like us who wants to be happy and doesn't want pain. And we go back to that meditation on compassion when we were thinking about our friend and how there's no real friend there. So there's definitely a way to be connected in a really healthy way with sentient beings, but without being attached to them. Because the attachment keeps us connected, but very often in unhealthy ways. And that's why our lives get like so tangled up, you know, emotionally, like, you know, like just this ball of gunk that you can't get out of anyway. Whereas, with the kind of love that we're trying to develop through our practice, there's some kind of, something flows much better. So let's sit quietly for a few minutes and think this over.